In other words, it's important to have a strategic view right now of some essential characteristics which go into making the personality. The most essential characteristic that goes into making the personality is spiritual courage. Without that, it's like there's no ground upon which you can build, and the whole structure doesn't happen. Or if it does happen, it happens in such a way that it's ill-founded. So that the most primordial value of all is the one that Paul Tillich, about a couple generations ago, wrote a book with that title, The Courage to Be. You have to have the courage to be. It's, if there's a need, a primordial need for human beings, that most primordial need is the courage to be. So the first thing that a teacher in a wisdom tradition wants to convey to the students in a wisdom condition is to encourage you to have the courage to be. By saying it in just such a sophomoric seeming way that you have a right to your own reality. Not to your egotistical version of reality, but to your actual reality, the one that you really are. You have a right to that. So that, for instance, when Jefferson writes the Declaration of Independence, his use of the term inalienable right is not a cultural idea, but it's on this universal wisdom level. It's an inalienable right. No culture, no hierarchy in this world has any basis to take that away from you, because that's who you really are. And any instrument that attempts to take that from you is usurping its own fundamental place, which is to be a part in a whole, because the part cannot take the wholeness away. So you have to understand that this is a virtual certainty. All wisdom traditions on the planet, all human varieties have found this to be true, have come to this same confirmation. And have put it on the strongest possible level. That your right to be is not given by anyone at any time, so that can be revoked at some other time, but it is an eternal, conditionless quality. In other words, you are guaranteed reality on an unconditional basis. But this is, as one would say, a God-given right. But it's given in such a way that it's eternal. There is no set of conditions anywhere in the real where it could be rescinded. Doesn't matter how bad you've been. Doesn't matter what you've done. It's not given as a reward. It's an unconditional reality, which is you. This puts the whole foundation then on an ethical basis rather than on a moral basis. So that sometimes later on when we get into the myth area, into the mythic section, and we see how culturally relative a lot of social values are. And you wonder, well, are there any verities? Are there any truths at all? This is one. Every person has the right to their reality. And this is not to say that it's an egotistical possession. That would be a misunderstanding. In the sequence of discovering this, there is a four-part ecology. Nature, ritual, myth, symbol. That four-part ecology moves from existence to the interiorization of existence to the symbol, the deep self. From existence to the deep self is a full cycle of that ecology, the four levels. Nature, ritual, myth, symbol. But as we go through that ecology, we're seeing that each of those four also is a quaternary. And we have to appreciate the difference, the distinctiveness. Now, nature and myth are related. Nature and myth are related. Existence and experience are related. They're related, they form. If some of you have been in the Thursday series, they are a platonic pair. They're not a polarity. To the ego, they're a polarity. To the deep self, they are complementarity. They're a pair. Ritual has its pair. What is the pair to ritual? Symbols. So that symbols have, in a very deep, arcane way, a structural relationship to the ritual comportment, what you do, do. Notice that symbols are not at all just an ideational summation of experience. That perspective is in error. That is not true. That's an egotistical scam. And just because most people would maintain that in the world, that's no recommendation that that's anywhere near the truth. It's incorrect. It's not true. Your deep self has a direct line, like a heart line, to what you do. So that if you want to realize the deep self, you have to pay attention to what you do. It's as simple as that. And it doesn't matter what you tell yourself that you hope you're doing, you got to be able to see what it is that you have done today and what you did yesterday. So that when tomorrow comes, you can do exactly what you really need to do so that you can get the honest result. So you can have the realization. There is no realization that comes out of fantasy. Fantasy is an endless sea of complications. But the real activity that we do is tied directly to realization. So that, for instance, in a short version of the ecology of activity, you can have enlightenment from an exact activity. That's like where meditation comes in. Meditation takes the language interface out of the play of ritual and symbol and puts the symbol and ritual in direct spontaneous juxtaposition. So that you can have any primordial ritual comportment sitting, whirling, in a Mevlevi dervish dance, it doesn't matter. But if you have a direct juxtaposition of that ritual comportment with your symbolic vision, that's where the sudden occurrence, the sudden enlightenment comes from that. But you have to be able to have honed your ritual comportment so that that particular activity that you're doing, whether it's sitting or dancing or helping the poor, that can be, it doesn't matter. There are many variations of this. but you have to have honed your sense of ritual comportment, your ethical responsiveness, so that that one activity becomes the summation of everything that you do. So notice that it's entirely correct when somebody says with great maturity, I'm doing this because that's what I am. That is an honest statement. That has real meaning. Someone asks Mother Teresa, why are you helping the poor in Calcutta? What do you hope to get out of this? And she tells them, I'm not hoping to get any. This is who I am. This activity is me. And that's entirely truthful. That's exactly right. Someone asked the Buddha, you know, what's next? And he smiles. There's nothing next. Spiritual teaching is exactly who he is. Never anything else. That's exactly it. But we're taking the longer form because we want to be able to appreciate in its fullness just how this activity happens. So when we're doing the ritual now, we're looking forward to the mythic section, we're looking forward to beginning to understand that language is a transformational medium that takes experience and brings it into vision. Ritual is linked to symbol by the mythic horizon of language. Notice here that that language has a particular tone. It has a distinguishing tone. The distinguishing tone of mythic language is that it's spoken. Its distinguishing tone is that it's spoken. Even if it's written, even if it comes to us as written, it's basically a written presentation of a spoken language. Mythic language is always a spoken language. Is it the French term, parole? The speaking. It's what you say. Notice that if what you say is founded upon what you do, that language becomes very powerful. Where is its power? Its power is that it generates meaningfulness in a very accurate way. Why? Why is it accurate? Because that meaningfulness has a direct line to existence. If your ritual comportment is honest in its comportment to existence, it will also recursively be honest in the language which you use. And so in this way, myths can be accurately true, but they're true in a mythic sense. I need this cough drop. Notice that the symbol is going, the symbolic level, the symbol, the deep self is going to occur in the midst of the transformational language of language, the transformational media of language as it is spoken, and its other pair, language as it is written. And a written language is magical. The very essence of magic, as distinct from myth, is that language is written, capable of being written. Even if it's spoken, it's a spoken version of a written language. Now, one of the key insights here, and don't get carried away with these ideas yet. There's plenty of time for that. But the key here is the realization that before a culture is literate, before it writes language, it is numerate. It writes numbers. There has never been a culture that has been literate before it was numerate. Why? Because the writing of numbers is a symbolic occurrence, and the writing of letters is a magical occurrence. Notice that the deep self the symbolic level, occurs in the midst of a transformational media that has two complementary modes. Both of them are modes of language. So that if you want to symbolize the deep self in a truly symbolic way, you say of the deep self that it is the word in the ocean of all language. Put in the ancient Sanskrit lineage, that word would be Om. Om. Om is the symbol, the word symbol of the deep self in the transformational media of all language, spoken or written. So that notice that in the ritual comportment, at its highest level of development, there's a direct line to the deep self. Ritual is not a lowly activity. It's not a primitive activity superseded then by more sophisticated things. Ritual, perfected, has a direct line to the deep self. It's like some of you are familiar with the chakra system. And the Anahata chakra is not just next in line to the Ajna chakra, but the Anahata chakra has a direct connection to the Saharastra, to the crown. You don't have to make that next step or so. It can go directly. The same thing in ritual. Ritual, when it's done exactly right, is efficacious of evoking the reality of the deep self. This is why it's not naive at all of a Saint Francis to perfect prayer. And you think, well, this is basically medieval Italian. That's not it at all. This is world genius on the level of Milarepa. Because if your activity is quintessentially honest, its poignancy is a direct line to the center of the real, which for you is your deep self. So that in our ritual section of this educational program, I paid attention to that. So while we've talked this morning about the first three levels in those pairs, the fourth level is the completion of the quaternary in the ritual section, and that is the 1 week interval at the bottom of the page. So that, I use the revised, so in the first 4 weeks of the ritual section, we had the sacred pipe and the bacchae as a pair. In the second 4 weeks now, starting next week, we're going to have the rites and symbols of initiation and the Satipatthana Sutra. This is the second stage. The third stage is the narrow road to the deep north and then Noah play. And then to round out the quaternary in a way which is true spiritually of ritual, we have the Mundaka Upanishad. All we need is 1 week. Because all you need on that level for efficaciousness is just one thing. Because it's the completion of the ecology, and the completion is always the joining together. The joining together is a singular event. One of the best symbolic ways of presenting this is the great Buddha at Nara in Japan. It's 47 feet high. And that great Buddha at Nara is in meditation, and the polarities are brought together in the hands that are brought together. And if you look at the hands are not joined like this. The hands are joined in such a way that the thumbnails meet exactly. And where the thumbnails and the great Buddha at Nara meet, they're about the level at which a human being standing has their head. And those thumbnails meet just like that. It's like that infinity sign in those two thumbnails. And if you look with penetration, that's held right in front of the Muladhara chakra. So it's like from the root of your being, your kundalini, it goes right through that paired thumbnail into your insight. So it's like a short form, like I tell you again, the Japanese are genius at this. It's like a symbolic short form that everything is telescoped into one instant. Everything that you would need to know. Except that if you don't know it, there's no way that you could figure it out from that. It's only valuable to you later on as a reminder and recognition that you have understood the ecology and there it is. So then you might have a little statue like I do out in the garden of the great Buddha at Nara sitting there, and the thumbnails are not very big in this one. And I put it on just a little bit of a pedestal so that it's about Anahata chakra level. If you go out and look at it, there it is. Well, you could have walked by it for years and years and never seen it and it didn't mean anything. Then now if you go there and if you go purposely to address it with your whole self, it'll ring just like a bell. Why? Because symbols are potent. And at the nth degree of ritual, the ritual activity is just one instant away from being symbolic. So the Mundaka Upanishad is the culmination of the ritual comportment. In Sanskrit, Mundaka comes from the root word which means razor. The razor's edge. What does the razor's edge do? It can cut through. So the Mundaka Upanishad is like getting rid of all of the excess, getting right down to the cutting edge of the mind. That's what the Mundaka Upanishad is all about. When I did that whole series at PRS, 2 years ago on the Upanishads, 13 lectures. You can dig out the cassette here on the Mundaka Upanishad and listen to it and read it. Doesn't take very long. And you should have a reasonable introduction to it. But now, that cassette and that Upanishad are put into a structural context where you can make use of it in a very precise way. If you're ready for it, you can cut through. If you're ready for it, it's ready for you. It's like that. If you're ready for sword play on that level, all you need is one flash of the sword. You don't even have to touch anything with the edge of the sword. It's so powerful that even just flashing the sword. You know, the Bodhisattva of mental power is Manjushri, and he holds a flaming sword. He holds it exactly here by the Manipura chakra. And it's like the little Dawa story in Chuangzi where the old butcher who carves up the sacrificial animals, and he's really good at this, and the king decides that he wants to have this special sacrifice, so he gets the best butcher. This is the butcher to bring in. He brings in the butcher, and the king stops him for a moment. He says, wait a minute, is that the knife that you use? And the butcher says, yes, I've always used the same knife. And the emperor says, oh, you keep it so sharp. And the butcher says, well, I sharpened it once when I was young, and I've never had to sharpen it again. The emperor says, what? And the Taoist says, yes. He says, well, all these other butchers, after they make two or three cuts, they hit the bone and all that, they have to sharpen their knives maybe a dozen times just to cut one ox up. I've cut up thousands of ox with this knife, and it's just as sharp. The emperor says, well, how does that happen? How is that so? And the Taoist says, well, it's very simple, actually. These other butchers are clumsy. They're trying to cut the meat and the muscle and the bone, and of course it's going to dull their knives. He says, I know how to cut, so I go in between. I go in between the flesh and the muscle and the bone. I never touch anything. My knife never needs to be sharpened. That's a little Chuang Tzu wisdom tale. So that when the deep self works, it works so perfectly it doesn't leave any trace that it worked at all. And if you don't know that it's already worked, you can walk around, you've already accomplished it, but you didn't. There's no way for it to register that you did. In this way, many people, to make it more dramatic, all people are already saved, it's just they don't remember that. And so they falsely worry, geez, I hope I'm all right. There's no way that you can't be all right. God from eternity has guaranteed your safety. I once saw in Hollywood a graffiti scrawled on a wall. It was beautiful. It was in red paint. It looked like blood at the end of the world. It said, don't worry. It's 100% out of your hands. Wonderful. A saboteur of the authoritarian structure, you see. But truthful. Don't worry. It's already accomplished. Yeah. Long ago, he was a great bodhisattva who decided to free all sentient beings, and he was successful. It's only our disbelief of that that keeps us entranced in this dream. So the Mundaka Upanishad, when we get to it, notice here that there's a four-part structure, just like in nature there was a four-part structure. What was the fourth part of nature? The fourth part of nature was the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu. So notice that there is going to be a juxtaposition of the Tao Te Ching and the Mundaka Upanishad, but a kind of a juxtaposition where there's no movement between them at all. It's a sequence where there's no movement. Stillness with a capital S. And if you get that, then it might occur to you, and notice how it's symbolic seeing, all right, nature ends with the Tao Te Ching, ritual ends with the Mundaka Upanishad, what would myth end with? What would be the fourth part of myth? Because that fourth part would go with the Tao Te Ching, the Mundaka Upanishad, and you frantically page through the damn pamphlet and you find it's Rilke's Sonnets to Orpheus. Holy poetry, Batman. Well, what about symbols, you see, and you page through it. The Cloud of Unknowing. Well, if you've never heard of Rilke or you've never heard of the Cloud of Unknowing, it doesn't do anything. But if you go through the course and work on this and just take it as it is, you don't have to force anything, there's no pressure. After a while, the alignments will occur. And it's just like in the ancient megalithic times. You don't have to tell anybody the meaning. After a couple of times of just working with the alignments of the stones and the stars, something in you gets evoked. And no one had to tell you. You remember what it's all about. That the pattern of the stars and the pattern of the stones are two complementary patterns, and that you occur as an interface between the two. And when you realize that you belong with the stones and the stars at the same time, then you're free. Then you're a part of the wind that blows in between, and you go wherever the wind can go. And even someone as sharp as Jesus said, no one knows where the wind came from or where it's going. No one. Because the mystery of the truth of life is open-ended. And go where it will go. Moses says, who are you? And he says, I am that I am. In other words, my existence is the seal of my truthfulness. There are no moving parts. There's no place to be compromised. And that without moving parts is the unity of the zero base infinity. The ego can't deal with that, incidentally. To the ego, that's just nonsense. And the ego finally finds a way to convince you, if you don't know that, that that's just nonsense. The ego has a very interesting way. The ego in the 1940s used to characterize it, well, any way you slice that, it's baloney. That's how the American 1940s ego used to discount a lot of things. Is that so? Very interesting. So when you're working with these texts, when you buy these books, hopefully you're not going to steal them, but hopefully when you get your copies of these books, keep them together in these pairs. In other words, I don't know where in your place that you keep your books, but try to keep them together in their pairs. And occasionally, you can even play with them. Bring them out and just put them into that kind of alignment. Because as you become acquainted, even just a little bit with these are potent enough. I've taken a lot of time, a lot of experience with this to select this out so that this works. These are my microchips. They work. When you get that alignment, even just in a physiological playing with the elements here, it's like a child who's playing with the letters, the little blocks, the wood block letters. I suppose they don't even do that anymore. But there's a magical moment where the child puts a couple of letters together and sees the word. Wow. Just that step is a step that is an unrevocable remembering of freedom. And when the child can put letters together to make that word, he moves out of the mythic level into the magic level. And then he wants to know, whenever he sees written things, what does that say? And when a child reaches that level, that's an incredible magical level, when the child can ask you, what does that say? Notice the language that he uses. If those letters could speak, what would they speak? But he's seeing symbolically. He's seeing magically. Then the memory of the child comes into play, and not just the imagination. Before that, the child's whole comportment is an imaginative comportment. After that, memory comes into play. And one of the side effects of that, of course, is that the child begins to remember potent images and potent symbols, and goes through a little phase of fearing the dark, or goes through a little phase of being negative. Very soon after they learn to read, they learn to say no, or learn to say, I don't like you. It's essential, it's necessary, because it's playing then with the polarities. And they need to have that freedom to do that. They have to be able to say no. And later on, the no transforms itself into the why. And they go into that stage where they ask, why? Or my daughter used the phrase, how come? And you can tell them, and then how come that? And you can go on all day. I tried once to see if there was any end. There's no end to that. You can go on for hours and hours. And they, like little yogis, will follow that pattern, because that's the natural pattern of the distinction making, the diuresis of the Platonic dialogues. And the child, because they're remembering their deep self, is like universal intelligence there. And you're going to be kind of stressed out later on, because you realize that they can ask questions longer than you can answer them. Because they have infinite resource of curiosity, we call it, but actually it's infinite insight into the fact that you can keep on finding out. Why? How come? One little side trick here is that you can, one technique here is that you can match their awakened, just newly remembered universal self by curling it back to them. It's not making a short circuit. It's not making a little tape loop, but you have to feed back so that the answer at some stage goes back to them. For my daughter, it occurred to, she was asking how much I loved her. And I said, I loved her as much as can be. And when the deep self works with that, of course, as much as it remembers, that's it. And there are no more questions along that line at that point, because that's a realization. Then the how comes in, and they take your hand, and they want to go somewhere. Then they're just kids again. Suddenly, then they're just maybe 3.5 years old again, whereas 2 moments before, they were of infinite age. How old is that child then? It just, there's no end. I mean, if you have the eyes to see, you can see a universal being. Endless. So the child is an archetype, as well as a junior member of the human family at the same time. So that ritual is just like that. It's a junior member in the ecology of development of human beings, but it has the capacity hidden deep within it to be a divine child. So it does no good to say that people who do these rituals are primitive. Or the American Indians are primitive. That's not it at all, because at a certain juncture and level of their ritual comportment is an excellence which is the divine child coming through. I've seen this. I've seen this myself. That level is a penetration, so that the ritual no longer is just a circle of activities, but the center of the circle, the unseen center, comes into play. And so you can do the circle of activities, but if you do it well enough, if you perfect your ritual, you perfect your circle, it becomes easier and easier to intuit the center, the unspoken center. So it's true that so-called ancient peoples were ritualistic, but they were not ritualistic just to trap themselves in a closed universe. They knew that perfecting that closed circle disclosed to them the unseen center, so that the ritual, when it's matured to this level, becomes religion. Now notice that there's an intelligence all the way. You can have a distinction between ritual and religion, but when ritual is perfected, it is religion. That's what religion is. The circle of what you do discloses the center of who you are. So that what you do discloses, finally in its perfection, who you are. The doer, and not just the deed. The perfection of the ecology of the deed discloses the doer. It's a very high truth. So that even at the beginning of the dawn of the career of our species, 100-some thousand years ago, there were masters of wisdom. How do you know that? You don't have to find graves with flowers over the dead in. One can know that from the structure of the way this ecology runs. You can know it through scientific gnosis. You can understand that that was true. I think we'll end there, and let me just say this. Let's turn off our tapes.